Carrie. The other day, you were telling me something about your toaster and how it just wasn't working the way you wanted it to. Can you finish that story?
Sure. Yeah, I don't like to complain about things in my home, but I do have one expectation in my toaster, and it fails often. I have a habit of wanting to stop the toaster before it's actually done, because I don't want my toast to get cooked on the way, apparently, or burnt. So I always try to push a button to make it pop up early, but every time I do, I push the wrong button. There's three buttons on the toaster. Every time I try to get the toast to come up, a blue light comes on. Nothing happens. So I just frantically push all the other buttons until it works.
And this is an occurrence that happens weekly, daily?
I mean, I would say weekly. I think for me, the agitation about it is heightened because I am a UX designer and I feel like things should work well.
Yes. Well, do you know who you would give your feedback to about this toaster problem?
No, I would take it to Goodwill and go get a new toaster.
Yeah.
Totally. Or just complain about it on a podcast.
Well, I don't think it's uncommon for us to experience frustrations in our life with the products we use or our household appliances. There are many times that things just don't work the way I expect them to or want them to. And yet I use them every day. And it is a frustration. It's interesting because products that are designed well often go through many processes. And when good user testing is left out of the process or the community isn't considered before something gets designed, there can be gaps or there can be things that are not considered. And that leads to frustrations and or just getting rid of the product, not adopting the product, or throwing it out altogether, finding a new system.
Thank you, Carrie and Tiffany. What an excellent segue into our podcast this week. Today we'll be discussing how important it is to communicate the value of sharing user feedback and collecting user feedback from at-risk users. And we'll be particularly focusing on those individuals who are maybe not previously or not voluntarily engaging in user feedback collection. And so I'm thinking specifically of folks who are maybe participating in a digital security training or who are part of a long-term support engagement when it comes to an audit or some other security support that folks are providing. So oftentimes in these situations, these people are coming to security experts, again, to trainers or to auditors, really looking for support with their digital security. So their end goal is just to improve their own security or maybe improve the security of their organization or their community. And so they're not necessarily looking to vent about a tool or some challenges that they're facing, but nonetheless, they are facing these frustrations. As Carrie and Tiffany highlighted just a few moments ago, we all face these usability challenges in our daily lives. And there are many products and tools that we do rely on regularly, but still cause us those little points of frustration. And so today we're going to talk about why it's so important to integrate feedback collection into our digital security engagements and include a few examples of kind of how we've seen those pieces of feedback be conveyed directly to developers and then inform the design and development of tools that we're relying on. So I think before we jump into the conversation, I do want to just highlight a few resources that we've shared before. So we've talked a lot about in week one, the ecosystems of these tools and the tool teams that are behind the tools that we rely on. So we know that there are lots of different setups. And so we have private sector tools who often have a lot of resources, both funding and human resources. And then we have some kind of middle of the road tools that maybe are more open source. And they do have a pretty robust team of individuals focused on development or design. But maybe they don't have the same resources or the same funding resources that private sector tools do. And then finally, on the complete other end of the scale, we have some very small tool teams, sometimes even just one person who's working hard to maintain a tool. And they often have the most limited resources, both when it comes to time and financial resources. So today we're going to talk a bit about how when we go into these engagements as digital security trainers, as security auditors, or perhaps as designers and UX experts, how are we convincing our participants, so the folks who are coming to us for trainings and audits, how are we convincing them to fully engage and to share this feedback with us? And how are we letting them know that their feedback is actually being heard? So I think to kind of give us some concrete examples of what this actually looks like in practice, I'll give a quick example, one that we've shared before from our usable experience, but I'll highlight it once again. So very early on in our usable days, we conducted some trainings that we called tool feedback trainings, where we were inviting a group of participants, a digital security trainer, and an open source developer to all come together in the same room. The trainer would introduce a tool and train the participants on how to use that tool. And the developer would simply observe that process and kind of see how the users were engaging with the product or the tool. So one of those early engagements took place with a Mailvelope developer who was able to watch firsthand some folks engage with the tool. And immediately it came to light that some trainers and some experts in the field were not able to recommend Mailvelope at the time because it didn't offer a way to encrypt attachments. And so for many folks, that's a routine part of their workflow, and it's a requirement for them, whether they're engaging with their colleagues or with other people in their network. It's really important that they be able to encrypt their attachments. So the lead developer of Mailvelope, being there in the room, hearing that feedback firsthand from folks, realized that this was a huge barrier for adoption and that there were people who were having to choose other tools over Mailvelope simply because it lacked this functionality. And so though it was not an easy process, the developer was able to take that feedback and turn it into an actionable change and a concrete change to the tool. So we're super excited that today Mailvelope does include that workflow, so you can encrypt your attachments. And that is, again, a huge feature that allows users to continue to use Mailvelope and use it for all of their needs when it comes to engaging and communicating with their networks. I also will highlight just one other example of a tool that we've worked with known as KeePassXC, which is a password manager. And there were many kind of UX and UI concerns with regards to KeePassXC, mainly with regards to onboarding and things like that. And so I'm also excited to announce that through their participation in the UX Fund, which is that targeted support for usability and accessibility improvements, and by engaging directly with some at-risk users through the Usable project, the KeePassXC team was able to implement some major UX and UI improvements in their latest release. And we have heard from the team that that was in large part due to their engagement and their participation in Usable. So these are just two examples of where direct user feedback was turned into concrete changes that ultimately made open source tools more usable and easier to use for these at-risk communities who rely on them on a daily basis. I'm quickly going to pass it back over to Carrie to give us one more example of tools that have implemented feedback based on users.
Yes, thank you, Ashley. The example I would like to speak to is a project, an app we've worked on with Guardian Project and Witness, and that is Proof Mode. Proof Mode is a very simple app that turns your photos and videos into secure visual evidence. And at the conception of the project, when the app was created, there was really no or very slim user interface. There was like one screen, and it was, and it's great. It's meant to work in the background. It's not something that you go in and interact with all the time. The model really is you turn it on, you set it up and turn it on, and everything happens in the background for you. And then when you need to share evidence and whatnot, you actually do that from your camera gallery. So the model is tight. I'll say it's tight. That's a word I'd like to use to describe it. It's great. What we had noticed and observed was over time was that people weren't really understanding how to do it, like how to share the evidence out. They weren't completely understanding what type of metadata and evidence was being generated.
And that was, so that was the piece that we focused on in the round. I'm trying to remember when we actually did this work. It was last year. But when we went in and really considered, took that feedback in and considered what it would mean for the design of the app. And we're able to do a lot of really great updates, which you can find in the app now. But I think the thing to highlight now in this podcast was that all of that work was enlightened by the feedback and input that we got from communities.
Amazing. Thank you, Carrie, for sharing that story. I will now kind of transition us. And so we've listed some examples or given some examples of kind of, again, those key impacts or key changes that have come or directly resulted out of user feedback. But now I'm going to pass it over to Georgia to share more about, so how do we actually convince users that they should be providing feedback and what's the value for them, particularly for those who are maybe not voluntarily participating in user feedback, but are just looking for that digital security support? How do we let them know the importance and communicate that importance to them?
Thanks, Ashley. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think one of the big things there is actually somewhat was in your question itself. So in order to help people realize that giving feedback is useful, you kind of have to frame it in how it can provide value to them. And that might mean actually sort of provoking a conversation around what's challenging about the tools and in that support relationship, talking through this is how it works right now, but that doesn't mean it is how it has to work. So this kind of speaks to a little bit about what you brought up earlier about reflecting back on the ecosystem blog post from week one. Some of that's about, you know, helping people understand that there is an ecosystem behind these tools. There's people building them, there's people designing them, there's people hearing feedback on them. And those teams are of very different sizes, but actually they really critically rely on hearing the voice of the people who are using the tools. And so those actually by giving that feedback, that's a way for their voices to be heard. I think a piece of that that's really important that then you can focus on is how to make that actionable feedback. So how can you flag, like an example we were thinking about for actionable is, you know, if you see that a translation isn't correct, rather than just telling someone that it's not correct, providing them alternatives to that. So it's not just saying, oh, that's bad, but saying like, this doesn't work because, and then providing some context. And then, you know, if you have ideas about ways it could be different, sharing those, all those types of input and feedback, you know, allow the end users to have a voice in the process, allow their ideas to then feedback and improve the tools. And it lets us test their assumptions that went into building the tool itself.
Awesome. Thank you, Georgia. That is very, very true. And I'll just quickly pass it over to our folks over at OK Thanks to add to this.
Yeah, thank you, Ashley. I wanted to highlight as well, having the feedback on a continued basis is super useful in our process to help keep things in check. I'll say it that way. But to really make sure and ensure that our understanding of how a tool can be useful and helpful for people is actually the correct understanding. Something also happens when once something, a tool is developed and is in someone's hands, it's very revelatory to see how people actually end up using that. And sometimes going into the process, and even if you go through it, like in-depth user research process to really understand, sometimes there can be surprising outcomes when it's actually out there in the wild. So that feedback is really important and valuable for teams. And the goal is for people to recognize that value and to feel like their feedback is very important.
Oh, go ahead, Ashley.
No, I was just saying I love that concept of making sure that, or the long-term engagement with tool teams. And I think I'll just quickly highlight that that is something that's really unique about Usable, and that we have been able to identify specific tool teams, primarily those in the open source space, who are interested in receiving this feedback. They have already expressed that interest. They've committed to engaging with users. And so sometimes it can be frustrating when you feel like you're shouting out into the void and you're not sure if people are listening. And so I think that's something unique that Usable offers, by letting folks know these are a list of developers or tool teams who are interested in your feedback. They want to engage long term. Ideally, they're also receiving funding through the UX fund, so they have the support to actually implement those recommendations. So we can drop a link on our website or highlight some of those tools once again. But we do have that information in our UX feedback collection guidebook, where we have identified those tool teams who are interested and open to feedback. So that can help you kind of narrow down your focus and really prioritize your efforts. I'll pass it back to you, Georgia.
I was just going to add, kind of to both of you are saying, I think one thing that's important here is to make sure that you manage people's expectations in that process. Just like making anything that we do, or even like the work that we do around digital security trainings or campaigns and advocacy, or the work that the organizations that we're working with do, things take time, changes take time. So I think it's important to make sure that people understand that their feedback might not lead to an immediate change tomorrow. There are some times when it does, and those can be magical moments, but it's important to know that sometimes, you know, a team might need to wait until they have funding for it. A problem might be harder to solve than people initially thought, or it might just need to wait until there's someone available to work on it. And so things like just remembering that there's people behind these tools and that they might need a minute to get to it, I think is a really important piece of it.
Yes, that's also critical to highlight. Thank you for bringing that up, Georgia. Kind of building on that and this idea of how do we manage expectations when it comes to users? So we are asking them to engage. We're asking them to share that feedback. What happens when folks maybe don't respond, or those responses take a long time, or it takes a long time to see those changes? Carrie, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on kind of any tactics that you all have used in the past.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think there's not always a clear answer necessarily if you give feedback and you hear no response. Every team is different, so I can't honestly give great advice on that. I do think that, within the teams that we work with, we do try to be responsive and to integrate the feedback collection that is happening into the process that we're working on at that given time. We'll also, so integrating with kind of what is relevant for a tool at a given time is helpful. Also integrating feedback through the Usable programming is helpful also, because it ensures that the resource is there and the focus is there from the team. There is one other thing that I wanted to share, but it left my mind. So I will pause there, Ashley.
No, perfect. Thank you. I think kind of, again, reiterating Georgia's point of, you know, we have to think so much about the back-end infrastructure. And Carrie, I think you all have highlighted this as well with some of the tool teams that you all have worked with at OK Thanks, of oftentimes it's not a lack of interest or like a lack of motivation. It oftentimes is a lack of bandwidth or a lack of resources. And so I think making sure that we're communicating that to users, that just because their feedback request has maybe not been immediately integrated or they haven't received a response, it doesn't mean that it was not good feedback. It doesn't mean that the tool team hasn't seen it or received it. It often just means that maybe that's not on their roadmap. And I think kind of by throwing out that term of roadmap, for folks who aren't familiar, oftentimes tools will have a kind of an idea or a list of things that they're planning in the future. And oftentimes those are related to privacy and security, particularly, again, when we're talking about this community that we're working in. And so it is sometimes difficult for them to reprioritize their list and to add in that usability or that accessibility component. When they are so focused on just the core development of the tool. And so reminding ourselves consistently that development teams are balancing all of these priorities at the same time, while usually having a pretty limited staff, or if they do have a robust staff, they're probably getting more requests and having to cipher through all of those and prioritize. So there's lots of competing priorities that are happening at the same time. And so I think that's one way that we can manage the user's expectations of, just because you produce feedback or share feedback and don't hear back, it doesn't mean that it's not being received. And it also doesn't mean that it's not being added to a list. It may just be that that list is very long and we won't see kind of the fruition of those changes for several weeks or months or sometimes even years. All right, I will just quickly pause and see if there's any other thoughts or recommendations here of how we're managing expectations when it comes to users. Maybe we've exhausted our expertise. All right, so we can go ahead and then transition a bit. So Georgia, I'll ask you to maybe share some examples of what happens when end users aren't involved in the process. And some real world examples of how that can go wrong.
Sure, happy to. I think something that even happened this week, we're working with a project that is building a tool that isn't launched yet. But we're in this, like, we're sort of the users testing it at the moment. And it's a tool that's supposed to run in the background on your computer and run every once in a while. And it didn't occur to the development team yet to build in a quit button. So every time you launch it, you end up with multiple versions of it running and you have no way to close them. That's obvious. There's no button. It doesn't respond to like keyboard commands for quitting. And I think that's just a great example of, sometimes we're so focused on our goal of what we are trying to achieve, we forget to make sure we look at all of the things that we might need to consider. Like another thing that I've seen sometimes with teams is they might not realize that they didn't think about how to approach internationalization up front because they were, again, focused on meeting a functionality goal and then trying to think about how to come back to that. So they might have left out how to handle right to left to support, for some languages or just even the ability to handle internationalization. Accessibility comes up in that a lot too. And those are really important things that hearing from the community about what their priorities are, what needs they have, is really important.
Thank you, Georgia. Yeah, I think those are a few examples, but obviously those are not unique necessarily, and they're probably more common than we'd like to admit, since a lot of tools are often built with really good intentions, but oftentimes based on those assumptions that teams have. And so critical to really highlight how this user feedback process can help us combat those assumptions and really challenge those assumptions that we have as tool teams or as developers to make sure that we are really serving those communities that we're hoping to and those at-risk folks who are relying on our tools. I'll pause once again just before I close us out to see if there are any final thoughts from our panelists here joining us on the podcast. All right. Well, with that, I will go ahead and close us out then, and I'll just highlight a few kind of key points from our conversation. So one, just reiterating that tool teams, whether they're private sector or they're open source tool teams, regardless of their size or their structure, they really are so dependent on collecting feedback from at-risk users, or users in general, I should say. We hope that they prioritize the feedback of at-risk communities as well. I also want to highlight again that there are so many different structures and tool teams, but at the end of the day, behind every tool and behind every product, there are humans, sometimes one human, sometimes five, sometimes 20, sometimes hundreds. But regardless, they all kind of come back to that core element of humans are designing and developing these tools. I also want to just reiterate that as we're engaging with users through our digital security trainings or through our audits, there are easy ways, and I'll use easy in quotation marks because I guess nothing is really that easy, but there are somewhat simple ways that we can integrate feedback collection into those activities. So we're still meeting the needs of the community, we're still improving their security, but we're also making sure that they have that critical voice in the design and development of those tools. Again, particularly focusing on at-risk communities who often aren't represented in traditional user testing. You know, they're not maybe the folks who are able to participate in the Facebook studies or in the Google user testing that average users are. And so these opportunities really provide a safe space for at-risk users to convey that feedback through a trusted intermediary, through a trainer or an auditor. I also will once again just make a plug for in week one, we had the blog post on ecosystems. So we'll encourage folks to look back at that to get a better understanding and to just humanize the folks behind these tools so you can understand the different levels of resources that people are working with. And I'll also highlight a resource that we're sharing out for week three, which is on synthesizing and prioritizing feedback. I know it's come up several times today on the podcast, kind of how it's important that feedback is actionable. And so as a trainer, as a developer, as a designer or UX expert, sometimes it's critical that our role is reviewing that content and helping to package it in a way that is most useful for the developers or the tool teams. And so in many cases, that means taking some less than helpful feedback and turning it into that actionable or concrete recommendation. So you'll hear or see or read some of that, some tips and tactics for doing that in the synthesizing and prioritizing feedback blog post that'll be released with week three. And with that, I think we can officially close out our week three podcast. Looking forward to another great week of programming with you all.